The world-famous Conservation Canine Camp will next be running in southeast Queensland, Australia, from the 21st to the 25th of August. Join us with your dog to start your journey into conservation detection. Visit padfoot.com.au to book your place today. Hello and welcome to the Conservation Canine Podcast, the show that celebrates the dog teams protecting the natural world. I'm James Davis, and in this episode, I'm joined by conservation dog handler and researcher, Dr. Annegret Grimm-Zeifard from Monitoring Dogs. We talk about differentiating between mink scat and an otter sprangt in the field, and some of the findings of her research into the use of conservation dogs worldwide. Hey, Dr. Annegret Grimm-Zeifard, welcome to the Conservation Canine Podcast. Did I get your name at all right there?
Thank you very much. Yes, it was perfect.
Really? I doubt that, but it'll do for now. Everyone, check the show notes to get the correct spelling of Annegret's name. So you're well known now for your research in the working dog world, but originally, I believe you specialised in the impact of climate change on reptiles. So can we start by talking a little bit about your background and what led you to, you know, looking at and researching conservation dogs and working dogs more generally?
Yeah, true. So my background is in general population ecology and the effects of global change on populations and ecosystems, species and so on. And so I was actually working with several species. I was working down under with reptiles in the desert where I did my PhD. But I was also working in Germany. So I always spent like a few months in Australia and then a few months in Germany. And I was working in Germany with mammals like the Eurasian otter. And that's actually where I started to come to conservation dogs or wildlife detection dogs, whatever you call them. And it was actually based in 2010 when I was a bachelor student and I did an intern with Eurasian otter monitoring. And you do that by looking for the scat, and which was okay. I mean, martens generally also mark on high, like exposed places. So it's kind of okay to find them. But then it's biased on the one hand, so you never get anything that is hidden. And also you never get the correct species, like exclusively the correct species. And so we ended up having like 30% of other species just because that landscape was so full of fish that so many other species just fed on fish. And for us, it was just like the same. Yeah. And so I felt like there must be a different method of approaching that. And I was into dogs very much. And I felt like, hey, that would be a cool idea. And I digged into literature and figured out, hey, there are actually people doing that.
So how did you really kind of get started? So you're working there, you know, you were digging into the literature. You discovered that other people had the same good idea that you had. So right. So where did you go from there? How did you kind of end up where you are now?
So I first started collecting literature. I thought there can't be too much out there, which was apparently not correct. And so I started reading through it like 2 years. And in 2012, I decided, okay, now it's time to get my own dog for that. So I had dogs before, but they were not suitable for that kind of work. And so when I was in Australia, it was actually the same year when I was in Australia first time, I kind of fell in love with those Australian cattle dogs. And I also figured out that the like most known company that time, which was Working Dogs for Conservation, they also use cattle dogs a lot or cattle dogs mixes. And So I went to shelters in Germany, and there's actually a rescue organization for Australian cattle dogs. And I found the most suited dog for myself, which was like a little crazy and a little over and not very much suitable in families. And but he was really cool with my older dog. And so I said, like, this is the one that I'm getting. And yeah. And then we started the journey of how do you train a weird dog to become a working dog?
And how did you do that? How did you work with anybody in particular, or did you kind of make it up yourself as you went along? How did you get started with that?
Yeah, back in 2012, there was no organization that could really help you in Europe. So it was kind of unknown, despite people were using it in the UK, for example, since I think it was the 50s or 60s. But it was not known in Europe and not in January, not in Germany, definitely. And so I started working with a trainer that had experience in detection dogs in general, for work, but also for as a hobby, like pet dogs. And so we first started, how do you teach your dog really to smell, and how do you teach your dog to alert, and all those things that I would now do different. But but that time it was the only way I could figure it out. And yeah, it worked, actually. It was a really cool working dog. So we got him imprinted on OtterScan very fast, and he was like running crazy when he was allowed to search. And it worked actually perfect. And then I also went to other organizations that started using detection dogs. So there was this Swiss organization about an invasive beetle that is destroying the trees in Switzerland, also in Germany, actually. And so they had a lot of experience with the dogs, and they also had cattle dogs and Labradors and so on. And so I went to them and watched them, what they do. And later on, I came to know Louise Wilson from the Conservation Canines, Conservation Canine Consultancy.
she's a good friend. She's a good friend of the show.
Perfect. And so, I first kind of stalked her, what she's doing. And later on, we also were able to get her over to Switzerland, where by that time I had other colleagues also working with OtterScan detection dogs. And so we kind of got together and got her over to train together. Yeah. And then there were like little seminars here and there popping up where you could join. So it increased fast and a lot. And nowadays there are trainers that you just go to and say, like, look, I would like to have a wildlife detection dogs. And they're like, okay, let's do that. And yeah, by that time it was just, how do I start? And now it's, it's really cool.
It's really good now, isn't it? That, there's a lot more of us out there that people can come to, I guess, to get right. the support and the help they need. It also kind of creates a bit of a market for people that don't really know what they're doing. So that's always a bit unfortunate. It's people working out who to talk to. I mean, there's, if you're lucky enough to get to train with Louise, for example, then you're getting much better training than you might get from somebody else who's just popped up and seen an opportunity, I'm guessing.
Exactly. It's kind of popping up here and there. And I don't really understand why, because then you have a dog which may be trained on something, but it's never deployed, because there's not a huge market where you can jump on, and so many scientists or conservationists are just happy to have more dogs. It's that there's no market for that. There are a few projects now where it can help, like voluntary, which is cool. And I think it's a win-win for both, but you still need to make sure that those people are really properly trained. And also like the species they are working on, you can't train a volunteer on an endangered species. That's just not working. Like from a legal perspective, even if they would be perfect, it would not be working. So yeah, it makes it really hard. And I know trainers that say, like, look, if you come to me and you show me you have a project and you have your own species or licenses and so on, then I can train you, but not otherwise. But I also got to know of trainers that just said, like, okay, you want to have a wildlife detection dog, so we just go for that.
Yeah, and I think it's a problem. I don't know if you listen to the podcast much, but it's a topic that comes up quite regularly that we talk about with lots of different guests, that conservation dog work is different. It's different to narcotics detection or explosives detection or sport nose works or anything like that. I mean, obviously there's similarities, but the conservation dog world is different. The requirements on the dog are different. The requirements of the projects are different.
And
unless you know that, it's very easy to think you could train in it. To say you've got a strong background in sport nose works, you'd think, oh yeah, I could train a conservation dog.
Right.
But it's the unknown unknowns, isn't it? It's the bits that you don't know that stop you from realizing that you shouldn't be doing it.
Unless you have also experience with those species and kind of know how they move, for example, or what they do, like how they behave, or even plants, like where do you find them? And the issue, you can find so many plants at one place and the dog is running crazy because it's not understanding which plant to alert it and so on. There's such a huge variety. There's not the wildlife detection dog, the conservation dog. It's just like there's a different dog for every different project.
Mm. Yeah, exactly. And that's a really interesting point you raise, because I always say that to people as well, that, you know, to do this work properly, you've got to be a bit of a naturalist yourself. You've got to be interested in what you're searching for. You can't just go out and kind of go, well, I'll train my dog to detect whatever it is you want to find, but not really know anything about your target.
Absolutely.
You know, you've got to have that interest, to really understand, the behavioral ecology and all that other stuff, you know, of what you're looking for.
Definitely.
You know, because obviously you need to get a result. We've got a moral obligation to support the use of dogs as a valid scientific survey method, you know, and we've got a moral obligation to set the dogs up to win. So
if you don't do it properly, then you may just end up with the dogs are not working, and it just comes back to all of us and
a very frustrated dog. So let's talk a little bit about your research then, and we'll get stuck into your more recent paper in a minute, because there's lots of stuff in there I want to tell us all about, because it's really interesting. But to start off with, you did a paper originally back in 2018. Yeah, so how to detect elusive species, detecting dogs in nature conservation. So was that the first kind of paper you'd authored in this space? Was that a first look at this sector? And what came out of that?
It was the first scientific publication. So there are a few German publications, like book chapters, or where we have been invited to other books to write a small paragraph, like dogs can help here and there, and why should we or could we do that, and maybe also why don't. But the first scientific publication was the one with the Eurasian otter, and our goal was from a German perspective, it was not known. So maybe for a US or Australian perspective, it sounds ridiculous to check it over and over again why the detection dogs are working. But from a German perspective, it was just the unknown that made people cautious when deploying those dogs. So we said, like, okay, we will train the dogs to find the Eurasian otter and to discriminate from other species. And so the main other species in that region is the American mink, which is an invasive species in Germany. And it was released from farms, like fur farms and so on. And now it's happily spreading through Europe. And it also likes fish. It would also feed on other things. But if you are working in an area where there's just such a huge amount of fish, they almost exclusively prey on fish. Mm-hmm. And so that was the main issue. The dogs should be definitely able to clearly distinguish if that poo is from an otter or from a mink.
Yeah.
And so that was the first main goal. And we trained four dogs. Two were trained on the otter and two were trained on the mink. Mm-hmm. And the otter dogs were my own dogs, and the mink dogs were actually also kind of volunteer. So another person that usually works with search and rescue dogs, but she's very fast in training her dogs other things. And so for that kind of, we kind of tell it a simple discrimination test. And for that, it was just perfect to have more dogs.
Yeah,
and it was three border collies and an Australian cattle dog, and it took us maybe half a year to really figure out how to do that properly. And again, I also was in contact with other trainers. There was one trainer that formerly trained police dogs and is now into conservation detection. But he was also training, I think it was drug detection and explosive detections before. So he could help me a lot with how do you approach a discrimination training.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so it ended up like with really great results. The dogs were able to detect the Eurasian otter. I think it was way above 95%, and the mink dogs were still above 90% or something like that. And we compared that to experts because, you know, you always have experts in the field that say, like, there is no way that you could not discriminate those cats in the field. They are so completely different. Yeah, I would never mix them. So we said, like, okay, we train different categories of people as well. So we take experts that are trained anyway, and we also train students because that's how the monitoring is done. You know, you don't have like 20 experts running through the field. Yeah. And if you have an expert, they're not running through the field anymore. And so they usually train other people to do that. And so we have people that are there like the second season, and they were, or third season, and they were kind of like intermediate. And then we also had like fresh new students that were newly trained on detecting the scats. And we compared their abilities to discriminate the scats with those of the otters. And we figured out that the students that were just trained the first season, it was kind of a random choice if they picked the right or the wrong species, like really 50%. And for the experts, there were like one expert was able to discriminate 90%. And the other one was, I think it was just a little bit below. So they ended up being like 80-85% on average, which is still very, very nice. But again, you don't have 20 years experts for field monitoring and not 20 persons of them. And it took us, like, once we knew how it worked, it took us maybe 3 months to train the dogs to discriminate. And it took us, or it took the experts 10 years or longer to become an expert. So the balance was clear. And so the first goal was reached. The dogs were actually, better and reliable for those comparisons.
Okay. So that's really good, which leads me on to a question. So obviously doing the discrimination work in the lab when you know what's what is easy. Once you get out into the field, and that's why I was going to ask about the difference between the otter and the mink scat, and whether it's kind of readily obvious, because obviously part of the risk when you're working with conservation dogs is rewarding false indications and so on. So how did you get around, you know, if it's hard even for an expert to be 100% positive what it is, then how did you make sure you were marking and rewarding the correct behavior?
Yeah, that's a very critical question. And I know that people approach it differently, but I just can't hold myself, and I need to praise the dogs when they find something. There are people that can hold themselves and say, like, okay, we are in the field, I'm not rewarding you, but look, we found like 20, 30 samples a day. And I don't think my dog would still keep on working if they would not be rewarded for any of those. And so what we do is that we train the dogs in field-like situations where we have someone who knows which scat is what. Mm-hmm. So it's not the handler, it's not the dog. And hopefully it's the dog, but the dog hasn't seen the procedure, how they were placed and so on. But there's someone around, like just waiting around the bush or somewhere waiting for us to detect the scat, and then and checking if the alert is correct or not. And there I would wait for the dog to alert. I would like tell the helper to where we found it, and then they would say, like, okay, yeah, there was an otter scat, or no, there was a mink scat. And so just after this person would tell us if it was correct or not, I would reward the dog, or would eventually not reward the dog. It actually rarely happens when you did the discrea that in those field settings, field-like settings, so to say, they alert at a different species. And if so, we would not reward it, and we would start over again. But again, it really rarely happens when you did that properly. And so what we end up in the field is we really reward every find. And so we kind of trust the dog. And the important thing is that we always go back to those field settings afterwards. So we never run hundreds and hundreds of field trials and without checking if the dog is still correct. We always go back to those field settings like every month or second to check if the dog is still only alerting at otter or if there was any mistake meanwhile. And luckily, so far, this procedure worked really good. And the dogs, like, it never happened in the genetics that we found a mink species. You sometimes have genetics that are not working, and you don't know if there is maybe markings by other species on top of them, because like fox and other martens, they mark across everything, you know. And so that's we're not sure about that, but we never had mink or something inside. So so far it works, but I'm quite sure you have to check your dog, because there can be one or two false rewards, and then the dog says, okay, from now on, we also look for mink. Fine.
Yeah, and it's really interesting, isn't it? And that that mirrors an approach that I would probably take as well, in that if my dog doesn't ever false indicate in training, then I'll trust it in the field, you know, because it knows, yeah, it's never been, if I've done my training well and it's never been rewarded for the wrong thing, then, you know, it's not going to indicate on the wrong thing.
Yeah,
because it wants its reward. So
exactly.
So I think trusting your dog, it is really important, and I don't think people do so enough. Or I told a story on I think it was on the Christmas episode podcast, where I was just working with my dog in an area, and I was convinced something should be there, and handler bias came in, and I made my dog work over the same area until he was just looking at me with just disgust. You know, and it was just me thinking, no, there's got to be something here. And there wasn't. And, you know, it's just, yeah, you got to trust your dog, you know, in this line of work. So, no, that's really good. Is there anything else on that particular piece of work, you know, that any findings or anything you wanted to mention?
Well, we also went out to the field with the otter detection dogs, because that was our main aim, right, to detect the otter. And also those were the really like working dogs for that specific issue. They were bored for that specific issue. And so we went out to the field and also compared the like standard approach with, we always paired an expert and a few students and searching for a transect. And then we paired one dog and one handler. And of course, those people like didn't exchange in between, so no one knows what the other one had found and so on. And we put them on the same transects, wild transects, so we never knew before what's happening there. But again, it's such a dense populated area, so you basically remove scats on one evening, and the next day you have a lot of new fresh scats there. And so people had to walk the same transect on the same day, so with the same fresh scats from the last evening. And we checked like how many scats each team found and how long it took, and if they reached the whole transect, and like how far they reached in that whole transect and so on. And we also figured out that the dog teams were faster, and they found much more scats. So what I previously said, it's actually not so hard to collect any otter scat, because they also mark on exposed stones and wood and so on. And but the dogs also found those that were hidden under leaves and that were like just on bare ground, and no one actually knew before that they also just poo on bare ground. And so we found all of them, and so it was like 3 to 4 times faster and longer transect and more scats in the same time. So there was really no like open point left why the dogs couldn't help us searching for otter scat. It was just like great.
just obvious, they're better.
Yes.
Cool. Okay, that's great. So let's move on now to the more recent piece of research. I don't know whether you're working on anything since then, but in March last year, Detection Dogs in Nature Conservation, a database on their worldwide deployment with a review on breeds used and their performance compared to other methods. Snappy title.
with a lot of scientific it's a papers. German title. You're not long.
so let's talk about that, because I would strongly recommend anybody working in this profession to get that paper and read it, because it's full of really interesting stuff. So let's talk about the things that you found really interesting in it, and other people that you've spoken to find interesting.
Oh, where to start? So the first impressive thing is actually how much is out there and how much is hidden in the literature, which you just don't know about. And I said, when I started that back in 2010, I thought like, we may end up with a few hundred papers, so easy. And then from year to year, it became more and more and more, and it became impossible for me alone to manage the literature. And I invited two co-authors to help me and also help me translating things, because actually we also looked into different languages. Because what often happens is that people don't do it only scientifically, but for companies. And so there may be progress reports or project reports. And so maybe sometimes they also help the NGOs, and they don't have money to publish it at all. And then it ends up in newspapers or something like that. And So we ended up checking all the literature in different sources, but of course with the main focus on scientific papers and big paper. Of course, we didn't include anything else about that to not like overpower one specific study. So and so that was actually the first thing, that the impressive amount that you find and the increase in the last years. So there is a super steep increase since the 1990s. And now we end up with like 60, 70 publications per year, scientific publications per year. This is amazing. And it's hardly manageable. Meanwhile,
it's a lot. Yeah.
It's a lot. And I found it super interesting to check through the history, like how it all began, starting with the dogs in New Zealand that found birds. Ground breeding birds.
Yep.
You are much more familiar with that than me. and then in the 1930s, when they started in the US, they discovered actually the grouse they were hunting, or grouse. I never know, grouse or grouse.
Grouse.
Grouse. Grouse. Yep. Okay, so the grouse they were hunting, they were actually declining. And just suddenly they thought like, okay, why shouldn't we use the same dogs for conservation and to protect them, to see how much is out there, how much we can hunt and how much we should protect and so on. And so they just decided to, use the same approach for conservation, which I found really cool. And also quite early, they started using those dogs for mammal detection and in reptiles. So there are studies about reptile detection dogs back in the 70s or even in the 60s. Who knows that nowadays? And I mean, in our fast living society, we usually know what happened last year, but nothing that happened before.
I think that's right. And that's one of the really interesting things about your paper, that you've gone into that sort of stuff. And I always find it interesting, because coming from a sort of hunting, shooting background myself originally, I'm always surprised that that's not more closely tied to the conservation dog work, because that's, as you say, I mean, that was a natural sort of starting point. People with a vested interest in conservation, which initially was the hunting community, using what they already knew to do a different, a different job in the same context. So, it's not so much like that anymore. And so it's interesting.
And also interesting, how many breeds can be used as detection dogs? We found almost 130 different breeds that have been used. That is, it just shows the variety of the targets, of course. So which breed you may use better for this or that target, but also the variety of dogs that can be used. And it's more an individual thing than a breed thing.
So let's talk about that a little bit, because that was quite interesting. There were some kind of odd breeds in the list in the paper that surprised me a little bit.
Which ones?
Just the Spitz and those kind of primitive breeds and that sort of thing. And I just, from where I'm working, it's all gun dogs or herding dogs type thing. And so it just took me a little bit by surprise. So where, I mean, was there any sort of different areas that we were typically using interesting breeds that weren't used in other parts of the world or anything like that? What did you find out?
So there is a difference among continents, but it's actually not very large. So of course, pointing dogs are more used in those regions where you use those grouse detection or quail detection. So it's usually the UK and also North America. And as you just said, the Spitz is, of course, more used in Eurasia, or all those Spitz types, because they are just from there. Yeah. And actually, you can train them really good. And so there are at least Spitz breeds that really want to work with you. And so, it's kind of understandable. It's just not a very common breed nowadays. So also in Germany, despite we have German Spitz and so on, it's not so common. And it's not so common to train them at all anymore. But they are not the worst. When it's about Spitz and primitive types, it's really more the Spitz and less the like Huskies and so on. They are not so common in that kind of work, because they are more independent. They are they may not be willing to work with you for you, not necessarily the whole day. And then there's for example all those eradication programs in the Antarctic and subantarctic islands where they use terriers, which kind of makes sense. Again, they are those detecting rodents, and it's just what they are bred for. And I don't remember many other differences along the world, to be honest. So it was quite equally distributed, with those exceptions.
So talking a little bit more about the breeds then, so I've got a couple of questions that I kind of noted down, just to try and throw you, really. So is there an overall best generalist breed, so if you were going to go out and what you wanted to do conservation dog work, and you didn't know whether you'd be doing wind farms or aquatic or anything, what do you think would be, or did your research show you that there is an overall breed that's better at most types of work?
I would not say there's an overall breed that is better. It's like really proven significantly better.
Oh, but scientists.
But there's definitely a breed that is used when you just as you just said, you don't know where the your travel is going to, and then people usually use a Labrador Retriever. I'm quite sure it's not restricted to Labrador, and you could use other kinds of retrievers or similar breeds, but those are the breeds that you can deploy on many, many different fields. Nevertheless, you still have to keep in mind every dog is bred for a certain thing, and also the retriever is bred for retrieving, preferring to take things over alerting things and so on. But in general, I think you can't do much wrong with a Labrador Retriever in your whole life. I'm perfectly preferring, I personally prefer herding breeds, but it's a personal thing. And if you are happy to deal with overly dogs that are a little extreme in their working drive, then I go for a Border Collie, which is also one of those breeds that is very often deployed, and together with the German Shepherd. So those are actually the top breeds that have been used, and there was no indication that they failed with any task. But still, if you have something that is very specific, like the dogs should find ground breeding birds, well, go for a pointer. There's no point for me to take another breed for that. It will definitely work with other breeds. It may just take you longer, and where's the point for that?
So in the research as well, there was a lot of breed not mentioned. So a large percentage was breed not mentioned. So, right. I mean, was that just due to the fact of anecdotal, you were pulling from more than just scientific papers, or was it that you think the people writing those papers didn't understand that breed and genetics is relevant, or do you think it was just used to the widespread use of rescue dogs, shelter dogs, mongrels, that sort of thing?
The second thing, so it's actually when it's in the news, then people tend to spend a lot of time saying what kind of dog it is, how old, how beautiful, and which breed, and so on. But if it's in scientific papers, sometimes you find, like in the whole paper, you find like one sentence saying, "We used a dog to find scat." This is all.
Yeah.
Thank you. at least then there's this information that it's one dog. Sometimes they even say, we used dogs to detect scats. Thank you even more. So I don't know how many dogs, which kind of breed or type in general. And so there's no information. And the worst was actually an acknowledgement saying, we acknowledge the dogs that found the scats for us. So, okay, I mean, you can always refer to an earlier publication where they, for example, you have like multiple publications on the same study. You may not want to describe your dog over and over again, but then you could refer to the first publication. That's completely fine. But when you never wrote down your methodology and only mentioned that you used a dog for that, then it's a little bit hard for us to get any information out of that. Yeah. So, and especially with all the publications that happened a lot. And fun fact, there were more publications from Oceania that did not mention the breed used than from any other country.
Oh, honestly, our scientific community over here, they need to be. Oh, honestly, it's dreadful. I hope they're listening to this and taking note. So, okay, so putting aside the failings of the oceanic scientists, what do you think are the most important factors then for breed selection? So when you look at the typical types of projects, was there any typical breeds that came out better for something? So you mentioned before, yeah, ground nesting birds, maybe a pointer might be better for that. But was that displayed in the data? Or was there any sort of, say, whether if you're doing a wind farm job, this sort of breed is just better, and if you're doing something else, this is better? Was there anything like that?
So we found that there were breeds that were more used for those target species. Like you said, pointers are obviously more used for birds or nests and so on. And on wind farms, for example, we found that pinchers and schnauzers were more often used, but maybe also because this is a very defined target. So it's in the very defined area, and you may be able to deploy breeds that are not like pure working breeds, and it's just maybe easier there. But there was no sign that any of those breeds was actually better in those jobs. Like there was when there were pointing dogs more often used for birds, it was not that they were also more successful for birds. So that so there was no indication of that. So the breeds that are usually used are those of like working dogs, and most of them were sheepdogs and cattle dogs, then the Labradors, Retrievers, Spaniels, and so on, and the pointing dogs. Mm. And those are those, let's say, categories that also have pure working breeds inside. And I think unless you have a specialist that is like only into herding and don't want to do anything else, those breeds are generally very good for those jobs. But again, it's an individual thing nowadays with all those family breeds. You have family border collies that kind of don't want to work much for you. They may do a little agility, but they may not want to work for hours and hours in the field. And same with Labrador, obviously. So it's still an individual thing, and the dog needs to want to work with you, for you, and that maybe for the whole day. Again, if any breed was better or not, the only differences we really found was that terriers may not be the best choice, but that was actually due to the fact that terriers were used in those eradication programs. And we had those category when we ranked the dogs or the studies, if dogs were better or not than other methods, we had this category saying mixed results. And we gave it always when the dog was not the sole solution to your problem. And apparently in eradication programs, the dog is not your sole solution to the problem. You have poisoning, you have fencing, trapping, whatsoever. So you need a dog, of course, to search afterwards. Ideally, the dogs will not find anything. But then how do you rank them? Do you rank them as they are not working because they don't find anything? No, we found that actually not fair. And that's why we said we ranked the whole study as mixed results, because you need multiple methods to achieve your goal. And in other studies, you only need the dog to achieve your goal. And then, of course, the dogs were better than other methods. Areas are not better in comparison to other breeds. But again, you may also you may still want to, if you really want to use a terrier that really wants to grab into anything. So it's still maybe a little of like more work than using a Labrador or so.
Yeah. And of course, I mean, that's what you find if you do primarily predator control or invasive, predator control work, it's an integrated approach, So nobody pays you to go out there and just find them. Your job is to go out there and find them and deal with them. So obviously it's that integrated plan. Whereas with a straight survey method for looking for scat, for example, the dog goes out, finds a scat, you collect it.
Fine.
It's just on the dog, the dog there, I guess. So, okay. Another question. Any regions of the world using conservation dogs? Well, what's the best region in the world for using conservation dogs effectively? Who's best at it? I mean, we know the oceanic scientists are a bit questionable, but is there any?
You mean if there was a difference among countries, like
No,
there was no difference.
No,
yeah, that's I didn't even report it because there was no difference among countries.
Oh, that's a shame. I thought that would be really interesting and cause a lot of controversy. So, that's a shame. But anyway, what can we do?
No.
Okay, so then. Conservation dogs versus other methods. So obviously you've been through all the literature, you've been through all the other publications. Were you able to kind of correlate or pull something together about how conservation dogs are performing versus other methods?
Can you say it again? Sorry, the connection was just lost.
Sorry, yeah. So from the review you did, how successful were conservation dogs versus other methods? I mean, so you obviously talked about your project proved that conservation dogs, were better than people searching for the otter and minx cat. So when you were looking at all these other pieces of work done all around the world, were you able to sort of work out how much better dogs are overall from all that?
So there were only like 600 and something studies comparing that. So it was not the whole database. But in those studies, 90% of the studies actually reported that the dog was the best suited method. So they either were faster or they were able to search a bigger area, or they found the correct species in comparison to others and so on. And so it was actually impressive that 90% of those studies said it's just awesome to have this detection dog, and you could not reach your goal without. And in those other studies, actually in most studies, there were those mixed results that I just said, that you need multiple methods, or in some cases this method works better and in other cases the detection dog worked better. So that was another huge proportion of those 10% left. Most of those studies were mixed results. And then there were a very few studies where the dogs were performing worse than other methods. So it was not worth using detection dogs. And a few studies where there were equal results, where they, of course, end up saying, okay, if we yield in the same results, then we may not go for detection dogs. And we were also trying to find reasons for that. And I just said that there was no clear reason for any breed performing better. So it was not that. And so we digged into those studies. We figured out that actually in most cases, there were flaws in training. So mm-hmm. the dogs were not properly trained to the study. So again, the fact that you have a detection dog doesn't mean it works for your study. And then there was also an issue with the target density. So it also goes back to plant detection a lot. So for plant detection, dogs are not necessarily the best method. They are the best method when you search for rare plants or underground orchids in Australia, mm-hmm. as far as I understood, and single individuals or individuals that just come out of the soil. But they are not suitable for too much smell. For them, they are kind of trapped in a scent cone and they can't decide, and it's too much. It also happens when scat detection dogs search in latrines. They are kind of running crazy, which scat to alert it. but it's just it happens less often than with plants.
Yeah. Okay.
So yeah, that was another big issue.
That's interesting. So one other thing that jumped out at me when I was reading the paper, and this could just be my own kind of lack of education, so I'm hoping you're going to educate me on this. So to quote, you say in there, dogs used to detect contraband, poached, trafficked, or other illegally taken plants, animals, or animal components are frequently called wildlife dogs, but are not commonly considered to be conservation dogs, and you are therefore not considering them in the review. So from my perspective, I generally include all of those dogs within conservation. So I'm interested in, that was Hurt and Smith 2009 where that came from, or that was your citation in there. I'm interested in the rationale for that distinction and where that comes from, really.
Yeah, it's actually also a cut that we had to take in the literature search, because there's much more out there for poaching.
Yeah.
So, and of course, it has to deal with conservation. There's no question. And we kind of followed this definition because it made our search straightforward. So we were interested in the dogs that are really deployed on ground to search for the real animal or their traces.
Yeah.
While the dogs that are used for search for poached animals, trafficked animals, they are usually doing the vehicle searches or they are deployed on airports and so on, and they are just everywhere, and it's good that they are everywhere, but it was not the focus of our study, and it was also not the focus our question was, how do those dogs behave in the wild and not on an airport? So that's why it was just out of scope, but I completely agree. And I also know that in some of those conservation dog programs, there's a big part poaching or trafficking or so on. Yeah. And it totally makes sense. It was just not the scope of the paper to also review their work. And it's much more closer to explosive searches when you search for a vehicle for poached animals than a scat detection dog or, I don't know, newt detection dog that is out in the field.
Yeah. And that's kind of what I thought you meant, but I was keen to just understand whether there was something I was really missing in the scientific world about that.
So the same is also with medical detection dogs. There are so many nowadays, there are so many bacterial detection dogs and so on. They were just not the scope of our study.
No. Okay. Great. Thank you for clearing that up. For me anyway. So was there anything else that I haven't asked about that you found really interesting out of that particular piece of work?
I also found interesting that the study design had such a huge effect. So there are sometimes people saying, like, look, we have the study, and just as an add-on, we would also like to have a dog on it. And we could figure out that often this doesn't work because the study also has to be designed for a detection dog. And even if you compare a transect method, the coverage of a dog is completely different from that of a human. So for example, we were comparing transects with our newt detection dogs, and it was the same length of the transect, but the dog is running like 10, 15 meters left and right, while a human searcher is maybe going into like 3 meters into the woods left and right, and then trying to go on the transect. So it's hard to compare something like that unless it's properly designed.
Yeah. All the problems of being a scientist, right? Trying to get it all properly lined up.
Yeah, of course. I mean, if you want to do anything with the data afterwards, then they need to be standardized to a certain way. Mm. And if that's not the case, I mean, also if camera traps are placed weird, then you can't do anything with them. So it's the same issue. It's just that we are working with camera traps since ages, and now we know how to deal with that, and we kind of have to figure out how to best deal with detection dogs. And I mean, it was not like that so many studies failed with that, but it was an issue and it came up several times, and I found it just really interesting.
It is. So what are you working on at the moment? Are you able to talk about anything you're working on at the moment, or
we are much more into amphibians right now. So I was very much into reptiles back in Australia, but German reptiles are countable on like one hand, so it's not much. There's a lot that has been done already. So I'm more into amphibians right now, and they are the most threatened vertebrate species group in the world. So it's definitely worth investigating what's happening to them. And while we know a lot from their aquatic habitats, we actually don't know much about their terrestrial habitats. So we have a new detection dog now since 2018, and we are trying to go through the forests and check if we find the retreats of the newts, like where do they hide and what is the habitat there to protect them. And also because there's a lot of restructuring in the forests. Mm-hmm. So because we used to have lots of pines and so on, and they are now often cut down and new trees planted and so on. So there's a lot going on in the forests, and we need to know where the newts are in order to protect them. So this is one project, and another one is about the netherjack toad, which is highly endangered European toad. Yep. And it's a pioneer species, and we almost don't have pioneer habitats anymore. It's the same. We have another dog that is trained on netherjack toad to search for terrestrial habitats. And this just started last year, and it's I have a new puppy since last year, another Australian kettle dog.
Good on you.
Yeah, and now she's trained on that to check out. And this season we will go out and basically do the same, map their retreats and map those individuals,
great,
measure them, weigh them, and so on.
Excellent. Who's working with you on that? Who's helping you? Are you been talking to Nikki Glover with the newt detection, or
right,
been talking to Louise or anything on to get some help with
this? A lot. We talked to Louise. And also to Nikki, because she also has this great crested newt detection dog. Yep. Or now it's three dogs. it's a little different because we have a generalist newt detection dog, because mm-hmm. the great crested newt is really rare in many places. Yep. And if we would only go for great crested newt, dog may have one find in a few days. And in order to like have him finding more, getting more rewards and so on, and also because we are also interested in the other newts, we trained him on pond newts and alpine newts as well. And so, I think he would generalize to other newt species nowadays. so that's why it's a little different. But it's definitely helpful talking to those people. And also there were some people from Wagtails using newt detection dogs in the UK.
Yep, Aaron.
I had a quick chat with them as well. Yeah, but then we also, again, we had to figure out how it works best, because, it's another step when you work with real individuals than if you work with SCAT.
yeah, absolutely. It makes life a whole lot more difficult. SCAT's arguably the most valuable target because of all the things it can tell us, but it's also sort of the easiest from an operational perspective as well. So it's, then when you move on to live animal, it's a whole other world of hurt.
Absolutely.
So talking about Nikki and Louise, so you recently joined them presenting at the Wildlife Detection Dogs Conference. So for those that missed it, what were you talking about, and how did you find the conference? Did you enjoy it?
Yeah, it was amazing. It was really cool to get so many people from this different continents together. And I guess it was super challenging to find the appropriate time for them to talk. And but the good thing is now we have 30 days to catch up with everything. But it was cool. It was from training techniques through many different field stories, like what happened with some tortoises here and some newts there, and eradication in other places. So there was like the whole world of conservation targets wrapped up in 2 days. It was really, really cool. And Heath Smith, for example, from USA was there. So it was someone from Australia also. So it was just amazing to have all of them together.
Yeah, I think he had, I mean, so Heath Smith from Rogue was there, and I think Tracy Lytton and Fiona Jackson from Skylos.
Right,
down here
Skylos, yes, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, were there as well. So out of the ones that you've watched, and I know you haven't watched everyone's yet, but have you got any favourite presentations or anything like that?
Ooh, not really. I mean, Karen De Matteo was really cool to wrap it up. So it was not really, like if you follow her publication, it was nothing new, but it was awesome to listen to her, like
she's
personal.
Very cool. She's very cool.
She's so cool, and she wrapped it up so nicely for all of us. So I really, really enjoyed listening to her. It was the first time that I could really listen to her, and we exchanged a few messages here and there before, but it was just awesome. So
that's great.
But all the presentations were really good. So I can recommend watching them all.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah, we've got a great community here, haven't we? There's, you know, the people at the top of the profession are so willing, and I'm including you in this as well, so willing to kind of share your knowledge and your findings and your expertise, and that's what makes it such a great profession, I think.
Yeah, so definitely.
Yeah, that's very cool. So, look, Annegret, thank you so much for taking the time to chat. We've been trying to get this interview organized for a little while, so I'm really, really happy to have spoken to you. Really happy to kick off 2022 with you being our first episode of the new year. If people are interested in learning more about your work and following you, and just generally stalking you, how should they do that?
So I'm on Facebook. I have my name is on Facebook. That's the easiest. But there's also a small company that I'm running. It's called Monitoring Dogs. So you can also find that on Facebook, and I'll keep you updated if there are new publications, for example, or with some funny training videos or deployments and findings from us. And so if you want to watch that, you're more than welcome. There's also a YouTube channel where you can find the link to it on our Facebook page, I think. Otherwise, you can type in Monitoring Dogs into YouTube. You also find some videos.
I'll put some links up just to help everyone in the show notes anyway. But
cool, thanks.
Look, Annegret, really nice meeting you. Really nice talking to you. Take care. Have a good day. And I hope to catch up with you in person very soon. Take care.
Yeah, thank you so much. It was my pleasure to be here.
Thank you for listening to the Conservation Canine Podcast. If you've enjoyed the show, please like, share, and subscribe wherever you find us.